So yeah, Ratnagosha contacted me a while back, sometime in the autumn, I think, and asked me if I would be able to come and give a talk as part of this series. And I think it was as much the date as anything. I don't think I was chosen to give the first talk. I think it was the date that I was free, and it happened to be the first. But so I was asked to talk about the group and the spiritual community. So part of a series on what is the Sangha? And there's a chapter in Winnabante's book called What is the Sangha, which is called The Group and the Spiritual Community. And at some of the talks quotes from that, and of course you can read it, you don't need me to quote it, but I thought I'd bring in some of those quotes as part of what I wanted to explore. So to be honest, I found this quite a hard talk to prepare for a number of reasons, partly the state of the world, actually. I've been quite affected, as I'm sure others have, in some ways by the political situation in the world. And over the last couple of days, just hearing different things coming out in the news, and kind of, I didn't really want to give them the title policies because that would seem a bit too rational for some of the things that seem to be happening. But just feeling like giving a talk about the group when the group seems to be writ very large and seems to be very potent and powerful in the most negative of senses. And also, for all sorts of reasons, reflecting on the imperfections of the spiritual community. So there you go, I'm going to give a talk, and it's going to be an idealistic talk. And I want to say straight off that it's, it's not cut and dried. It's not like the group is all bad and the spiritual community is all good. I mean, if only... Well, if only the spiritual community was all good. But of course, people are people, and communities of any description are made up of people, and we bring what we bring into our relationships. So, but it is an important question for us as a community. What is the Sangha? What is community? What is a spiritual community? And I think, I often think the Sangha jewel, the community jewel, is the hardest of the three jewels in a way. I mean, I think it'd be hard for anybody who's a Buddhist to have any problem with the Buddha, generally speaking. And I think most Buddhists would find it hard to have any problems with the Dharma. But the Sangha is a whole other ballgame. And of course, when we talk about going for refuge to the Sangha, we're not talking about the community in the sense of the people that we share a day-to-day life with. The Sangha that we go for refuge to is the Arya Sangha. It's the Sangha of the enlightened, or at least the Sangha of those ahead of us, as it were, on the path. And yet, Sangha also covers that larger body. So there's the Maha Sangha, which is the community of all practitioners. And then there's the Maha Sangha in the sense of Tri Ratna, but there's also the Maha Sangha in the sense of anybody and everybody else throughout the world who's practicing the Dharma. And that's a big Sangha. And I also think in some ways there's a community beyond that of people who are just trying to live through their values and whose values in some way resonate with our own values, whether they would consider themselves Buddhist or not. So it is a practice. And sometimes people say, oh, you know, I really need a community. I really need the Sangha because it helps me in my practice. And I think, well, what is your practice then? Because in a sense, I think Sangha is a practice. So I guess when we say that, we mean in a personal practice, like my meditation or my Dharma study or something, is supported by and helped along by community. But actually, I think community is a practice in itself. The word means gathering, and of course a gathering can be a noun or a verb. We can be at a gathering, we are a gathering sitting here tonight, but of course we've done that by gathering as a verb. So I think it's important to think of Sangha as a verb as well as a noun. It's something we do rather than a place that we visit, as it were. It's not like there's the Sangha and we kind of dip in and dip out. To the extent that we're in relationship, we are making Sangha. So it's always been one of the things that characteristics, as it were, of Tri Ratna, the FWBO as it was before, that people often comment on, that we do friendship. People often say that. I've had that said to me by other Buddhist groups, people from other Buddhist groups. So yeah, you do friendship. And yeah, I'll come back to that. But in 2007, Sangra actually gave a talk. I think it was in the Birmingham Centre. And he was talking about the six characteristics or emphases of Sri Ratna. And one of them is spiritual friendship. And I think it was in that talk he said, I've got a quote here, he said, "This is one of the features of the FWBO that people find especially attractive. I get many letters and see many people, and they tell me how they came into contact with the FWBO. And the two things that draw them and value is a clear presentation of the Dharma and spiritual friendship. The fact that they appreciate this friendship so much suggests to me that often nowadays that element is lacking in people's lives. You may have friends or acquaintances, but maybe you don't have many people you can open your heart to, have a full and deep communication on all levels with. There's the dialogue with Ananda, the whole of the spiritual life." I'm sure you're all familiar with that, where Ananda says to the Buddha, spiritual friendship is half of the spiritual life, and the Buddha says, say not so, it's all of the spiritual life. So Bhante says that although that was said, as far as he knows, as far as Bhante Sangharakshita knows, this utterance of the Buddha hasn't been taken as a kind of central tenet in any, or certainly in many other Buddhist communities. Bhante said that when he heard that many years ago, he thought, why is that? And he turned his mind to it. And he felt that when he set up a Buddhist community, he really wanted that to be a strong central part of it. So he says, of course it's found elsewhere, but is it given the importance or the centrality? It's not easy to plumb the depths of what the Buddha really meant, but at least we can try to do that. So I think I want to just acknowledge straight off that I think that bit's important. We try to do it. So, and I think we do pride ourselves in being, generally speaking, quite a friendly organisation. And people often say when they come into a Buddhist centre that they're met with, warmth and welcome, and that that counts for a lot. And I think that's all fair enough. And I don't think we always get it right, which I don't think is that surprising, really. So in the talk this evening, I'm contrasting on the one hand what we've called the group, and on the other hand, the spiritual community. But it's not cut and dried. It's not like there's a great big line down the middle and that the group's at that side and then the spiritual community's at this side. It's a much more permeable wall, I guess, than that. Because all of us bring our own group values into the spiritual community. And also, not all groups are bad, necessarily. It's not that the groups themselves are bad. It's more group, the way we're formed and conditioned by the group. And I'll go into that in a minute. So we're aspiring to be a spiritual community. That was the preamble. I'm going to give you the talk now. So I want to start by reading from the Dhammapada. "How very happily we live, free from hostility, among those who are hostile. Among hostile people, free from hostility, we dwell. How very happily we live, free from misery. Among those who are miserable, among miserable people, free from misery, we dwell. How very happily we live, free from busyness, among those who are busy. Among busy people, free from busyness, we dwell. How very happily we live, we who have nothing." I was going to burst into song at that line, "We who have nothing," but I won't do it. Shirley Bassey, I will not channel Shirley Bassey. So in that, it struck me in those verses that we're describing the ideal community. Living free from hostility, free from misery, free from busyness. God, it sounds good, doesn't it? And it's being contrasted in a way with worldly values, being contrasted with a group, hostility, misery, busyness. So I'm going to just have a little look at that. But that's the backdrop, in a way, to the talk. So you've had the preamble and the backdrop. I'll get there. So I'm going to read you some of Banti's comments in the group. So this is from that talk, the group in the special community. He says, starting with the family group, the tribe, the state and the empire, we have inherited over the centuries a vast and complex web of groups to which we may be affiliated. Schools, businesses and multinational corporations, football clubs and rotary clubs, councils, churches, committees and societies, pubs, interest groups, political parties and so on. We belong to a social group or class, an economic group, a religious group, a cultural group, a linguistic group, a racial group. We're born into some groups, but we have to join others by conscious choice, by being initiated, by paying a subscription perhaps, by joining the colours, or whatever it needs, whatever that may be. So in a way, thinking about that, you can see it's not that in themselves they're necessarily negative. You know, that's not really the point. The point is that we are usually fairly unconscious about the conditioning that we carry from those groups. The important thing in practice, in a way, is to become more conscious. So it might be that in the end we still have the same set of beliefs, so the same set of ideas or ideals or values, but to come from them from our own conviction rather than coming at them because they're the group that we grew up in is a very different experience. So carrying on, Banti says, we have all been born into these groups and we are all therefore subject to the conditioning arising from these affiliations. Our ideas, our views, our feelings, the way we react to people, our convictions, all these will tend to be determined by group conditioning of one kind or another. Except insofar as we become conscious of such conditioning and distance ourselves from its influence. The groups themselves often overlap or even cohere, and all of these overlapping groups together make up the world as we know it. It's quite an interesting thing to start thinking about, and I think sometimes it's easy to see where your conditioning comes from. Sometimes it's harder, and I think it's, in a way, if you belong to a class or a grouping which has seen itself as in some way oppressed or as in some way disadvantaged, I think it's easier to see that. So I think it's harder, for example, for me to see my racial conditioning as a white person than it probably is for some people who grew up where race is such an obvious feature of their experience. As a gay woman, I think I could see my group in that, in a way. I could see the identity that I carried around with that in a way that I think many of my heterosexual friends couldn't really see it as conditioning because it's normal. So I think to the extent we see ourselves as normal, whatever that might mean, whatever that particular kind of conditioning is, it's harder, I think, there to penetrate into what that class or grouping has, how it's conditioned us and how our responses kind of come up. So I can really see that in myself, and in some ways my practice over many years has been unpicking some of those conditionings. And I realised a long time ago that I could kind of get a hold of my conditioning by the heat that I felt in response to certain things or certain people, certain accents, certain ways of describing the world. And it was quite hard to see that it was conditioned because it feels right. You know, it feels that, yeah, I'm right. I mean, for example, in case you haven't noticed, I'm Scottish. And I'm kind of Irish-Scottish, actually, so it's a double whammy. But where I really realised that conditioning was football. Okay, so the Scots traditionally support two teams. They support Scotland and anybody playing against England. And I remember in one of the World Cups, I can't remember what World Cup it was, but it must have been in the 80s because I was living in, or the 90s, 80s, I think, I was living in London. And England were doing really well. I mean, Scotland, these don't even make it into the World Cup these days. I remember when they did, but they don't anymore. And I found myself actually watching the game and I was thinking, God, England are playing really well. I really hope they win. And I thought, oh my God, what's happened to me? I'm changing. So, I mean, it's kind of trivial and funny, but actually it's extraordinary how deep these things actually go. And how something like that is so tribal. You know, it's so tribal. And all sorts of things, you know, I over-identify probably with my class. I over-identify to some extent. You know, the fact is I'm well-educated, but I still identify as working class, which is ridiculous. I haven't hardly done a day's work in my life. Well, actually, I have done a lot of work, but I haven't done a lot of working class work in my life. I've done some. You know, so it's like there are all sorts of labels in a way that we carry around and that do seriously condition how we're responding to certain aspects of the world. And thinking about this, it occurred to me that it's important not to become identified with being a Buddhist in a certain kind of way. You know, not to become identified even with being, say, Sri Ratna or a Buddhist. If we're identifying in that sense that we're not really kind of coming from a strong individual kind of place. And I, you know, I can see where it happens. I can see where sometimes my own kind of Buddhist conditioning gets a bit... It's been a long time, more than half my life within this particular community. So, of course, there are things and norms that I've taken upon myself. And I'd like to hope I've taken them consciously, but I'm sure I haven't with all of them. So there are sometimes things that I catch myself kind of responding to, and I think, oh, that's interesting. What's that about? So, you know, otherwise Buddhism becomes just another group. So it's really important that we're always aware of why we're responding to something, how we're responding to something. So in a sense, when Bhante identifies this idea of the group and group conditioning, in a way, I think it's quite an important teaching. I think this is when Bhante's, it's not a lost teaching, but it used to be talked about a lot. And I don't hear it being talked about so much these days. And I'm sure there are all sorts of reasons for that. Things change, they move on, etc. But it does strike me as a really important kind of way of becoming conscious of the kind of conditioning that I carry around with myself. And of course, there's a danger, as I said at the beginning, of cut and dried thinking, or we put things into boxes, so anything that smacks of a group is bad. And any kind of view that seems to come from a group, because we can have views that come from group conditioning, and they might be right views. The problem isn't the view, it's in a way either where it's come from, but also more strongly how we hold it. So a kind of right view held overly rigidly isn't particularly helpful either, really. How very happily we live free from hostility among those who are hostile. Among hostile people, free from hostility we dwell. So this is talking about metta. It's talking about the fact that a spiritual community will be held together by bonds of love and not bonds of power. Ideally, we're bound by the ties of love. That's what makes a spiritual community a spiritual community. But as I said, we carry our group values within us very, very strongly. I mean, I'm watching myself at the moment. I said at the beginning, I'm quite affected by some of the things coming out of America at the moment. Sorry, not America, the United States of America. America's a big continent. The bits at the bottom and bits at the top, but the bit in the middle. And I find it really, I'm really working at trying not to fall into just a kind of blind response to that. And I have I have concerns about the world. I have concerns about the fact that Trump was elected president. I've got concerns about the sort of things that are coming out of the White House at the moment. But it's also quite important, I'm trying really hard to work as a practice and not just getting into an us and them. Because in a way that is the basis of what group think is in a way. So if I'm identifying with the left or the liberal end or the sensible end or whatever, then in a way to the extent that I'm identifying like that and I'm categorising somebody else, it's really very hard not to, though. But anyway, I am working very, very hard not to kind of just box a whole group of people. I mean, I had the same thing in the Brexit vote last June, so I've no idea how any of you voted. And in a way, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. What matters to me was the kind of box or the bubble or the silo that I kind of felt myself to be in. And my assumption, in a way, almost that anybody sensible would have voted the same way as me. You know, and just somehow falling into that us and them kind of categories. And I think to the extent we do that, we really are not working in the love mode. And we're really falling into those group values, even though what I think I'm doing at that moment is anti the group, in a sense, but I'm creating my own. Yeah. So group values are strong, or even just the idea of being part of a group is very strong. It's kind of human. It's built in, I think. You know, it's built into our system to want to belong. Even introverts want to belong. They just do it differently, I think. But, you know, we want a sense of safety and being held by something that we agree with or that kind of holds us, yeah. So I'm reminded of the Dasadama Sutta, which the Dasadama Sutta is a sutta that talks about the values of having gone forth from the worldly life. And the very first of it, of those values, says, "I no longer live by worldly aims and values. This must be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. I no longer live according to worldly aims and values." But it takes effort. I mean, it takes a lot of effort, I think, to do that. I've got a favourite quote from a Star Wars movie, which is a Jedi trainee says to his master, "Why are the forces of dark so much stronger than the forces of light?" And the Jedi master says, "No, they're not. They're faster, easier, and more seductive." And I think that's really true. I think it's easier to go with group values. I think it's easier to go with worldly aims and values. It takes an effort to actually really take ourselves out of that and really, really work out what are our basic values and develop those values and stand up for them. So internally knowing what our values are and then being willing to stand for those values of love and kindness and compassion. So it strikes me thinking about this that all around us, in some ways, groups are breaking down. So when Bhante gave that talk, whenever it was, that is part of the book now on the group and the spiritual community, it must be in the 70s, he talks about the fact that nation states are breaking down and that class is breaking down. I mean, he's talking particularly about Britain, that's the society or the culture he's in at that moment and he's talking about. And it struck me, reading that and thinking about it, that in a way that's continued, but almost at the same time it seems the opposite has happened. That groups in some ways are stronger. And I think it comes from fear and insecurity in a way. And I guess as things do break down, there's a desire to fix on something else. And to the extent that, say, the church or values that were associated with religion in this country have kind of over the last probably century, actually, or certainly the last 50, 60 years, have disintegrated to a great extent, that I think it creates a desire to look for something else to give security. And I think, again, what we've seen in political decisions that are being made at the moment, not just in Europe or in the USA, but actually you can see it in a lot of countries at the moment, that people are desperately looking for something to cling to. And it would seem that that's what's offered, and that the right, to use that term, is better at offering something of that nature than the left is. And I think fear plays a really big part in that. Fear makes us want to batten down the hatches. And I think that's what we're seeing in the world. We're seeing fear sort of really taken off, as it were. I travel quite a lot, and after 9, I noticed a big difference between pre 9/11 and post 9/11 in traveling, particularly through the USA. The difference in kind of the way you're treated as you go through security and things like that is hugely different. And I think it does come from that sense of fear. There is a sense of, there's a kind of mentality of trying to, build walls. You know, there is a mentality of that. And some sense that building a wall will make us secure. Probably most of you are too young to remember this, but there used to be an advert on the telly when I was young. There was television then, and the advert was for an insurance company, and I can't remember what company it was, but basically it was a family. It was a nuclear family, daddy, mummy, child, and I think there might have been a dog, don't remember, and they're kind of all standing there together, and the insurance company builds a fort around them. Some of you remember it, obviously. And then the dad kind of leans over and he hits the wall, clunk, 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 and it's like, this is security. And I remember seeing this, I was probably a teenager actually, and thinking, I do not want that in my life, ever. I do not want a wall around me. It was a really strong response to something. And just that sense that that's going to make us safe, you know, somehow, whether it's a physical wall or an emotional wall or a kind of a barrier of some sort. The part of Buddhist practice, of course, is breaking through, trying to go beyond, trying to see where our self-referential behaviour causes problems. And I love the term that David Loy has coined, which is, no, we don't just have an ego, we have a we-go. And in a sense, the we-go are the groups that we identify with. And I find that really sort of quite an interesting concept, because we do, it's almost like, whether it's, you know, whatever that grouping is, where we kind of identify and we protect. And we want to be protected in a way. And to the same, in the same way that that sense of trying to protect something in me is completely false, it's also completely false to try and protect a we. You know, in a way, those barriers just have to go. That's part of the practice of Buddhism, is not just to break down our own barriers individually and personally, but actually to try and really break down barriers that keep people seeing themselves as us and them. Me and them, me and everything else out there. Another little quote from Bhante's talk is, the group insists on conformity, while the spiritual community encourages freedom of thought. And I think it's really important to remember that. He says, but this isn't all. More than simply freedom of thought, important though that is the freedom to grow. So in a way, we need spaciousness to be able to grow. And I take that as growth in clarity, kindness, compassion, generosity. So all of that's come from thinking about trying to create a spiritual community where there's metta and love as the kind of basis, and where we don't close ourselves off. Because in a way, that's what hostility is, isn't it? Hostility is kind of preemptive attack, in a way. Hostility usually comes from somebody or something feeling threatened. There's no need to feel hostile if you don't feel threatened. So to the extent that we consider ourselves as separate, either individually or whatever group we are identifying with, then hostility will arise to the extent that we identify with something that needs protected. So how very happily we live, free from misery among those who are miserable.
Miserable.
Among miserable people, free from misery we dwell. I'm not sure about the translation of that. I'm sure there are other translations. But it just paints this picture of the spiritual community all kind of like, you know, a bit like a Coca-Cola advert or a Pepsi-Cola advert. You know, I'd like to teach the world. And the group are all kind of walking about being really miserable. And actually, it's not really like that, is it? You see plenty of miserable faces amongst practitioners. And there seems to be a lot of happy people out there that are not practising anything like kindness, clarity or compassion. They seem happy. But we know it'll get them in the end. Karma rules. So, anyway, it's a very specific use of the term happiness, I think. I don't think it is happy, clappy, happy. I think the happiness that's being talked about in the Dhammapada is the happiness of living in accordance with our ideals. It's the joy that arises from faith. In the spiral path, we have dukkha, suffering, giving rise to faith, giving rise to joy. And that joy that can arise out of suffering and faith isn't always necessarily very happy-clappy, because it's to do with really seeing the nature of how things are and being able to live in accordance with that. So not trying to fix what is not fixable, not trying to kind of create permanence where permanence doesn't exist, not trying to be create substance where substance doesn't exist. But also, we've found ideals, we've found a practice, metta, we've found ways of kind of trying to live. And to the extent we live in harmony with that, we're happy. That's what happiness means in this verse, I think. It's a living practice. And there is a practice that we do in the generation of bodhicitta, which starts by just reflecting, all beings like myself seek happiness and its causes. All beings like myself again and again and again create the conditions for present and future suffering. What a pity. And it's a very strong kind of practice that, to reflect that we're all of us looking for happiness. And people look for it in sometimes the stupidest of places. And we do that, don't we? We kind of know on some level that something isn't really going to give us lasting, eternal happiness. But in the moment, we allow ourselves to be convinced that it might. And in a way, we seek happiness. But what we don't always seek are the causes of happiness. Because the causes of happiness come from living in accordance with our ideals, comes from living in accordance with a realisation that self-clinging does not bring happiness. And it's a kind of tragic irony, really, that in the seeking of happiness, a lot of the time what we do are create the very conditions for unhappiness. What a pity. So the spiritual community, in a sense, I think one of the tasks of the spiritual community is to remind each other of that, or to remind ourselves, but to remind each other that lasting happiness will not be found if we seek it in the places that cannot give it to us, in a way. And that, in a sense, true happiness will come by really breaking through that sense of ego clinging and self clinging, and allowing ourselves to really understand the love that will arise from that, of knowing that we are connected. So part of our task is to help each other also see where our conditioning leads to unhappiness, where our conditioning leads to present and future suffering, where the ways that we act within the world are not in accord or in harmony with our values. How very happily we live free from busyness among those who are busy. Among busy people, free from busyness, we dwell. I think I might just pass that one over. Well, I think, what I think that is saying is we need to have spaciousness in our lives. I don't think it means you don't engage with the world or with life, or you don't do anything. But I think it means it's the basis from which we do act, from where the basis that we come from. And the image that came to my mind in that was Tara, the image of green Tara who sits in meditation, but one leg is reaching down into the world and one hand is opened in generosity. So that there's that sense of coming from a deep inner peace, which is equanimity, which is not affected by whatever's going on around us, and that out of that equanimity we're able to act, we're able to step into the world, we're able to give, And Tara also offers fearlessness, which seems such a gift for the world today. So, you know, people say I'm busy, I do quite a lot, I'm a multitasker, and I understand that that can sometimes give the impression of being overly busy. I'd like to think that I do manage within that busyness to find a sense of peace and tranquility. But we're accused quite generally in a way sometimes in Triratna being over busy. And, you know, maybe there's something in that. But partly how many of us have chosen to practice is through action or through involvement with certain things. And this could just be my own temperament speaking here, or my own conditioning, of course, my own group sense talking. But I do think it's important that we do engage. I do think the world needs engagement. And I do think it's important that we come from that place of peace, because otherwise the engagement becomes us and them. And it is quite hard to find that balance. I mean, I know that some of you in this room are quite involved in what you might even call that social activities or activism. And it's like, it is a trick, it's a task, isn't it? It's an art and a way to learn how to do that in a way that doesn't pull us into those group values. When I first come back from Spain in 2004 or 5, or whenever it was, I was thinking, what would I do with myself? And I thought, I've got at least one more major project in me. Got another one in me. And I was talking to Banty about it, and I said, I'm thinking about politics, actually. But I know I'm too old, and it's too long since I've had any involvement in party politics, so I don't think there's anything I can do with that. And he was saying, well, local politics are probably a better way to get engaged anyway, because then you won't have to be constantly coming into relationship with party line. You know, in a way, he was saying he thought if you engaged in major party politics at a national level, it's harder in a way to hold your own values, because you're going to be constantly put into relationship with things that might challenge those values. I thought that was quite interesting. I also kind of thought I probably don't have the equanimity to do that. I don't think it's in my makeup, really. I like to think I'm quite passionate about things, but sometimes I think that is just an excuse for being angry at times. I mean, I think I do feel passionate about things, but I think I'd find it very hard to be constantly trying to deal with things that press my own buttons and kind of make me angry. However, I don't feel satisfied with not doing anything. So it's a dilemma sometimes, and I'm sure I'm not the only person that feels that, about how do you engage with the world. And I look around and I think it needs engaging with more than ever. I think the values of the Dharma are so crucial, really, in the state that the world's in. And yet, how do I personally, how do we as a community find ways of engaging with that don't shake us off our path of peace and love and tranquility, because you're constantly having to face those things. And I'd love to see our community more active and more tranquil. I'd like to see both those poles in a way kind of really strengthened, the reflective and contemplative, and the active. And I think they need to be in relationship with each other. And Sangha Rakshita has always been very keen on responding to the world. It's always been part of the discourse. It was part of what got me involved in Triratna, actually, was that I was looking for ways of changing the world. And then I had the realisation that you couldn't change the world if you didn't change yourself. But I didn't want to just work on myself. It was important to me that the community that I engaged with also had a sense of wanting to engage with the world. And one of the talks that I heard Sangha Rakshita give that really, really blew my mind, actually, was, I've talked about this in other talks, was a Padmasambhava Day talk he gave in 1979. So I don't know if anybody else would have been at that. I don't know if you were there. Sangapala might have been there.
No,
you were still up north, that's it, in 79. So he gave this talk. It was at the London Buddhist Centre, the East London Buddhist Centre. And it was a Padmasambhava Day, and Banty came and gave this talk. And it was quite a long talk. He'd no notes. He just stood there and talked. And he talked about the life and liberation of Padmasambhava, which is a text that some of you will know. I'm not going to go into the details of it. It's pretty wacky. It's a bit like a big fairy, big mythological kind of world that it kind of builds up, and there's all sorts of figures in it, and there's a figure in it called Black Salvation, who is quite an extraordinary figure, who does all sorts of things, including eating his mother, if I remember rightly, and various other things, which one assumes is symbolic. Who knows? Anyway, at some point in this talk band, he's talking about Black Salvation, and he's talking about how that's the demons that are in the world, and the demons that Padmasambhava had to deal with. And he suddenly goes off into this whole description of how he and a friend were walking through the city of London, and they're looking at skyscrapers, they're looking at the Bank of England, and they're looking at the Stock Exchange, and they're looking at these buildings that are there that house capital, really. And he says, he turns to his friend and he says, "This is what we're up against. This is one of the demons. Money, this sort of form of power, which has got out of control, is out of control of the spiritual principle. So there are economic demons, there are social demons, sociological demons, political demons. There are even religious demons, all of whom need to be brought under control. So we mustn't think of these demons as mythological things, you know. You can read about them in a fairy book, a fairy story book. No, that's all very nice, but you'll never really meet a demon. Well, you're meeting demons all the time, of one kind or another. You live in a world of demons." So there you have it. But he then goes on to say, actually, the only way to really deal with these demons is to meet them, to go into the heart of it, to go into the heart of the demon, and, as Padmasambhava did, make friends, or, you know, do whatever you need to do to bring those demons into a relationship. And I know people sometimes think of that as an internal thing, and there's a whole kind of way of doing that, of working with one's internal demons, feeding the demons, facing them, bringing them into relationship. But I think you can think of it socially as well, that in a way those demons are out there in the world, sociological, political, etc., etc. So that talk was in 1979. It's nearly 40 years ago. Would we say that there are less demons in the world today? I don't think we would. I think the demons that we're facing are even bigger, hidden, manipulative, behind the scenes. You know, I don't think they're even always that obvious. They sometimes come disguised as fairy tale princesses and princes, whatever your particular, you know, inclination might be. They come, as the Jedi Master said, they come seductively. They come quietly and they pull you in. So I think it's still true that part of the task of the spiritual community is not, in fact, to move away from the group. I don't think the spiritual community's task is to cut off and put up a wall, you know, group that side, us this side. It won't work. It won't work. We need, in a way, to be in relationship. Those of us who have made a commitment at whatever level to try and make those values more and more central in our lives also need to be taking them into the world. We need to find channels and find ways of actually working with those demons, because there's energy in them. That's the other thing Bhante says about that. He says that's where the energy is. So don't strangle them. Convert them. So the world really needs it. The other thing I think that makes it really hard, right, is the level of lying that happens. So you probably know this, but last year's word for the Oxford English Dictionary has a new word that they agree is a word every year. And 2016's word was post-truth. You know, post-truth society, post-truth politics, sometimes known as alternative alternative facts. Anyway, it just really struck me when I read that, how true that is, and how one of the demons, it's one of the new demons we've got, is just blatant, outright lying. And the thing is about post-truth ways of going about things is it appeals to the emotions rather than to anything else, really. So, you know, it appeals to often the worst in us. It appeals to kind of, it's like we want to believe something and we're told it, so we do believe it. Whether it's true or not doesn't really matter. And you can see that so often where something's spoken and said, this is a fact. And then it's completely debunked. But it doesn't really matter because we still believe, you know, I'll still believe it because I like it somehow. Anyway, sorry, I don't mean to go on and on about it, but it just really totally struck me that, like, it was a bit of a kind of, you know, just how hard then it is to know how to trust. You know, I think it erodes trust. It erodes trust in the media of communication. It erodes trust in a way in society, and it erodes trust even in each other in a way. If you can't really believe, you don't know where to put your faith in a sense, which is why the values that the Dharma can give us are so important as a refuge, as a way of finding a basis for their trust. We who have nothing, that was the end of that verse, wasn't it? How very happily we live, we who have nothing. So for me, again, this means the simple life, a way of living simply and fighting consumerism, which is a great big group. You know, it's a conglomerate, isn't it? So how do we move from being merely group members to creating spiritual community? That's really the question, isn't it? Well, you have to come to next week's talk. Is it next week, the true individual? 2 weeks. You've got 2 weeks before you find out. So we move from being group members by becoming truly individual. But I'm not going to go into the details of that because that is the next talk, is what is an individual. But that's in a way what we need to do. And I guess it's enough to just say that means really unpeeling, taking away these layers of conditioning and really coming into relationship with our true and deepest values. So I'm going to finish with a quote from another talk from 1971, from another talk of Bhante's. These are talks that have marked my own personal practice, by the way, that I'm just sharing with you. But they did seem relevant. So this is a talk called Evolution or Extinction, A Buddhist View of Current World Issues. So it's 1971. So in that talk, Bhante lays out all sorts of world problems that are going on, that are in the world, including the ecological crisis, poverty, war, etc., etc., lack of resources. Quite an array of them. And then he says, we can say that a consideration of these current world problems makes it clear to us that we have before us today only two alternatives. On the one hand, there's what we call evolution, spiritual development, becoming an individual. That's one alternative. And the other alternative is extinction. It really means that we, the human race, individual members of the human race, must develop spiritually, or sooner or later, we will perish. So what I understand by that in relation to the topic of this talk is to really see more and more how group values are driving us towards extinction. How many of the groups that drive the world have no sense of the future at all. It's greed. It's based on immediate satisfaction. And very, very little sense of the price that future generations will pay. So when Bhante talks about becoming more of an individual and an evolution, a spiritual evolution, I think he's talking about a sense of a shift in consciousness. A shift in consciousness that isn't just an individual thing, but that will actually help shift the fate of the whole human race. The whole human race depends on that. Not just the human race, but the whole of the planet, the whole of our ecosystem depends on that shift of consciousness and that shift of values. And he actually gives us four things we can do to help to do that. Because he goes on about, you know, the extinction and everything, and then you're getting a bit like, oh God. And then he says, but there are things you can do. You can respond. And there are four things. He says, find a method of personal development. So in a way, become more individual. Work out really, truly, what are your deepest values? Not just the values that you've inherited from all the groups that you belong to, but the real values that you feel are the values that the human race needs at this point in its evolution. And if we don't find a method of personal development, basically we're part of the problem rather than part of the solution. But he says that's not enough. Find, join or create a spiritual community, because you can't really do it on your own. It's so much easier to do that with other people. And then he says, withdraw from all anti-spiritual forces. So withdraw from all the groups that you are part of that you think are contributing to the... lost for words. Contributing to the dissolution of our planet, that are contributing to hatred, that are contributing to greed. Withdraw from them. And then he says, where you can't withdraw, influence. So they're the things I'm going to leave you with. So really, really finding out what are the values that we hold that don't just tie us to the group, but allow us the freedom of individuality. And how can we foster that in each other in what is obviously an imperfect community, and yet a community with aspirations, and not spending too much time caught up in the ideal, nor too much time finding the faults, but actually finding a way of embracing both the problems, the mistakes that we make, and the genuine aspiration to be a force for good in a world that desperately needs it. So, thank you.